This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Best Practice. I'm Lisa Leong. I'll be filling in for Richard Aidey for the next 5 weeks while he's on leave. In 1996, I was a lawyer working on one of the largest competition law cases in Australia. My job was to review boxes and boxes of documents in an airless, windowless room. I barely left the office for an entire year. It was the same year email was introduced, but it's fair to say that lawyers, well, we were a bit sceptical. We were told, never send your advice by email. The email is used to confirm that the advice is in the mail in letter form. I left law in the early 2000s, and when I returned a decade later, things had really changed. Advice is mainly provided by email. There's no need to sit in an airless, windowless room as there are virtual data rooms, and the document review that took me a year now just takes months, if not days. Technology is advancing at great speed, and artificial intelligence is increasingly becoming part of our lives. Think Siri, driverless cars, and personalised medicine. With all that rapid change, have you stopped to wonder what workplaces of the future will look like because of AI? Offices, factories, even truck cabs.
Hi, I'm Chrissy Lightfoot, and I believe artificial intelligence is a gift for us all. And having said that, I created an AI tool called Robot Lawyer Lisa.
Oh, you not only took my work, but you took my name too.
Lisa is actually an acronym that means Legal Intelligence Support Assistant.
I didn't know my name meant that.
Well, it does in this digital world, Lisa. You're moving on to become a cyborg.
Yeah.
I'm Tim Edwards, and I think the term AI is still largely hype. However, true artificial intelligence is definitely getting closer, and now is the time to plan for its arrival. I've spent 20 years helping to develop an intelligent system that prevents road accidents, and it starts with truck drivers.
I'm Niels Wouters, and I find artificial intelligence quite intriguing, actually. I will explain the ethical challenges of artificial intelligence analysing your behaviour in the workplace.
Oh, that sounds slightly ominous, but interesting. Chrissy Lightfoot. You're a legal futurist, an entrepreneur and lawyer, and you're convinced the legal profession is in for a big shake-up because of AI. Before we find out just how big that shake-up is going to be, let's start by setting the scene, beginning with robot lawyer Lisa. She's the world's first AI lawyer robot, launched just 18 months ago, and you're the co-founder. What does robot lawyer Lisa do?
Robot Lawyer Lisa is unique at this point in time because she is impartial and transparent. She basically enables two laypeople like you and me devise a contract between ourselves. So if you imagine that in the traditional sense, what usually happens is you or I would go to a human solicitor and ask to draft a commercial lease, for example.
Yes.
And that solicitor would act for one side only. Whereas because Lisa is a machine, there is actually no fiduciary duty between the two parties as such. Therefore, she can act for both sides. So Lisa actually advises each side. So if you're the landlord and the tenant, you can work and create this lease between yourselves as if you were being handheld by a human solicitor on each side.
So is it just for leases or other contracts as well?
It is for other contracts. We've created an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement as well. It's used in 77 different countries right now. At this stage in time, we've created four particular contracts, but we do intend to expand in the months and years to come.
And how does it collect the information from the users?
Basically, it is a question and answer, a series of steps that we take the user through as simple and quickly as possible.
And so I'm filling out a form with my information?
It's not a form. It's more than that. It's as you work through each step, you're actually giving the advice as you work through it. So we give guidance and advice. So you're actually given the legal information and commercial information before you answer the questions as well. So it's not form filling. It's not filling in like a template as such. It is actually as if you were being interviewed by a solicitor, and then the solicitor was actually creating the contract there and then. And it only takes 6 minutes for an NDA or 20 minutes for a commercial lease, which is far different to what we're used to working with from the behaviour point of the solicitor and the behaviour point of a user.
Does it only apply for UK agreement?
Yeah, at this point in time, we've created it so that it is English law and English jurisdiction. So it is used for anybody who is wanting to work or live coming to the UK.
How are consumers responding to Robot Lawyer, Lisa?
Brilliantly. We were really surprised, actually, because consumers, we do know that at least 7 out of 10 people here in the UK from the recent research say that they would prefer to use some form of online digital property-related contract tool rather than use a traditional solicitor. So we've got rid of that normal time delay and cost increase that usually happens when one side goes off and needs to use a human solicitor.
It's called Robot Lawyer Lisa, but it feels like at this point in time it might be overstating things because it's really a document assembly tool at the moment.
It's more than a document assembly tool. It's actually an expert system. And expert systems do fit within this umbrella of a catch-all AI as such. We've used the term robot lawyer just to differentiate, to not confuse the users, to make the point that it is actually a machine. We want to be transparent and act with integrity from a user's point of view to understand that, you know, they are using a machine. We do recognize that solicitors and law firms are actually using technology. They're using machines themselves, but don't always disclose or declare to their clients that they are actually using a machine. So, and some clients actually find that disingenuous when they do realize that they're using machines to speed up and do things more efficiently and accurate than the human and still getting charged the normal human solicitor's rate.
Do you think you might develop it so that there's some voice recognition built into it, like Siri? And if so, would you like me to lend my voice, given that you've also taken my name?
That would be fantastic. The answer to that is, in time, yes. We've made the decision not to do that at this point in time, because sometimes, obviously, like any dictation or using Siri, sometimes the systems don't fully understand what you are saying. And we feel that it's absolutely critical that the contract that is produced at the end of that interchange and exchange between the two parties is absolutely spot on.
What happens if Robot Lawyer Lisa gives people the wrong advice?
Well, in that respect, she doesn't, because the way that it works is the guidance and the pop-ups that happen as a result of how the user has answered the question. So they will be given those advice notes as such throughout the process. So she's not giving the wrong advice at that point in time. She's actually advising related to the question and then the response to the question.
So how did this all come about? Why did you develop this robot lawyer?
Mainly because I recognised there was a gap in the market as to how solicitors were actually behaving. Having been a solicitor myself and having been a buyer of legal services, I recognised that a lot of the problems for 80 to 90% of the population, whether that's Australia, Canada, America, England, it's all pretty much a uniform statistic. A lot of the population are actually not using traditional solicitors, and they're not using them mainly because of the cost element, also because the time involved and convenience as well.
How will AI impact on the practice of law in the future?
I think it's actually a great opportunity to vastly improve legal service and legal product to the mass market. More machines like Robot Lawyer Lisa and more startups and other companies coming into this space will actually educate the mass market, the market that traditional solicitors have never actually served anyway. So if traditional solicitors are only serving 10 to 20% of the potential marketplace, it seems a bit ludicrous that this 80% are neglected. And if you can create a machine that could actually scale that advice and those documents, it means that they are reaching more people who are in need of legal advice and legal product.
What's left for human lawyers?
The lawyers, for me, would be the high-end intellectual capital and the judgment-related work, because the lawyers would still need to oversee and maintain the machine.
Chrissy Lightfoot is a legal futurist, an entrepreneur and lawyer. You're listening to Best Practice on RN. Tim Edwards is the Chief Technology Officer at Seeing Machines. He has helped develop technology that reads truck drivers' faces. A camera's mounted on a dashboard to keep an eye on the drivers. Why, Tim?
Well, road accidents when I started out were a very serious issue, and they still are today. The road toll is still unacceptable. We saw an opportunity there to essentially prevent, you know, really, really bad accidents from happening. And we focused on trucks because these are the precious cargo. They have the very large mass on the road. If a truck's involved in an accident, you know, it's normally multiple fatalities. And in order to solve that problem, it's been very interesting. We've had to essentially invent an intelligent or expert system that is gradually taking steps towards becoming a kind of virtual co-pilot.
So what is the camera detecting?
The camera is looking at the driver's face, and it's not looking at a particular picture of the driver's face. It's looking at the driver over time, and it's making an assessment, is that person really concentrating on the road? You know, they will often be caught out daydreaming or distracted by something on the side of the road. And when your attention is lost, you know, seconds can pass by without your realizing how long it is. And there's some fairly clear guidelines around how long it is you should be allowed to look away from the road before the risk goes through the roof. You know, when we began this technology, it was very simple. It was the eyes closed, is the head turned away from the road? But now it's looking at, you know, do you appear to be making glance patterns or behaviours that would indicate that you're not really thinking about driving the truck, right? So, and in order to make this solution more acceptable to the truck drivers, it had to become more intelligent.
And so what's an example of it becoming more intelligent?
Well, simply getting it right, not telling the truck driver that they're distracted when they're not.
Okay, so let's say I was distracted as a truck driver. Mm-hmm. How's it going to tell me, hey, whoa, stop doing that? Is it a voice or does it punch me or
slap me
in the face?
This is always an interesting topic of conversation. You know, do we spray a little mist at you or something? No, it's quite simple at the moment. There's a vibration unit in the seat, and it basically just gives you a little vibration on the back of your kidneys.
Right.
And this, it just jolts you. It's like somebody sort of poking you in the back.
Right. And that itself must be quite subtle because you don't want it to shock me such that I veer off the road.
Well, it's interesting. So we have different levels of intensity and you do sometimes need to shock somebody. And so that's the question. When should a machine be allowed to really slap you in the face? Because it needs to save your life sometimes. So maybe that's the right thing to do under certain situations. Under most situations, though, it probably just wants to give you a little nudge and say, hey, please concentrate.
And so have you played around with that in terms of what the nudge or the vibration or the slap in the face might be?
Yeah. We have a professor of what they call human factors science that works at the company, and he essentially studies all of these kinds of, you know, ways to interact better with people and make the machine feel like it's doing the right thing so it doesn't offend people. And, you know, it's a very complicated area of science.
So
yes.
Has it worked to improve safety for truck drivers?
Oh, absolutely. It's once you show a truck fleet owner the statistics of things like high G events, hard braking events, number of rollovers that occur with trucks, these kinds of things, it basically stops them. And we've had, as far as we know, in over 10 years in the market, we've had, I think, maybe one or two accidents where we should have picked this situation up, but it's essentially reduced these accidents, which could be caused by distraction or drowsiness, down to zero.
And what about the response of the truck driver? Are there any feelings of being monitored, watched, Big Brother, etc.?
Absolutely, and that's the issue, right? This is why the system needs to become more intelligent. It's designed to assist, not control. You know, we don't want to be monitoring a driver just to monitor them to invade their privacy, and this is a really important area of education.
Now, we all know humans can be judgmental about people, especially their appearance, but what about computers? Dr. Neil Swalters is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne. He's been considering the workplace of the future, in which the company interviewing you may well decide whether or not you'd be a good fit for their workplace based on a photograph of your face. Niels, we've heard about some of the positives about AI, but you've developed what's called a biometric mirror, and through it you do want to alert us to the potential dangers of AI. So what is a biometric mirror?
The biometric mirror is an interactive application that basically takes a photo of a person standing in front of a screen, standing in front of a camera, and then analyzes that further to distinguish a whole list of, psychometric information. It shows you your age and your gender, but it goes into the very intimate aspects as well. So it shows how weird you are. How weird you are, exactly, whatever that means.
Right.
How emotionally unstable, how attractive, how responsible you look.
Now, I'm getting quite nervous here because I previously provided you with three photos. Photo number one is my LinkedIn photo. So I'm wearing a suit, I've got makeup on, and my hair is neat. Photo number two was a selfie, no makeup, messy hair. I'm smiling in photo two. And then photo three, tried a different one, a selfie again, no makeup, messy hair, but this time I decided not to smile. Okay, so that's photo one, two, three. Oh, and another distinguishing factor is that even though I'm born in Australia, my mum is Thai and my dad is Malaysian Chinese. So I haven't seen my results yet, and you're going to share them with me right now. Did I get the same assessment for the three photos, Nils?
No, they were very, very different from each other. Yes.
Right. So that's interesting in itself. Should we start with a distinguishing characteristic like ethnicity?
There was one where it said you're from Asian descent.
Yes.
You were African in one photo and Caucasian in the other.
Wow, that's interesting. And what I've got to ask you about weirdness.
Two of your photos, you were perceived to be quite weird, whereas the other one you seem to be, just the average person. I think it illustrates how quickly you can get it all wrong.
Yeah.
But look, our system is pretty dumb in a way. It doesn't recognize that it's Lisa Leong three times on these three different photos. It just recognizes three faces. So it's not anywhere near as clever as Tim's system or as Chrissy's system. But that's basically the reason why we developed it. What if all of a sudden a company would develop a product with such a dumb system such as ours and launch that into the market, and that would start to have consequences for people?
So who is making this assessment is going to be important here. So who did you get to assess weirdness, happiness, and ethnicity?
It's a crowdsourced data set. So that means that we have sent a couple of 10,000 photos to a few thousand respondents across the globe, actually across the US, to be really honest.
In the US for a start?
Yes. Amazon Mechanical Turk. So that's basically an Amazon-owned crowdsourcing platform, you could say. But it tends to be quite biased. So it's very popular among 18 to 25-year-old Americans, typically people without a job or no education, typically also Caucasians or white men. And I guess that illustrates already the problem.
And so is this potentially an indicator of what might be happening with artificial intelligence systems in the fact that somebody has to create the algorithms, the stuff that makes it work?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always a human in that chain somewhere at some point in time. And that's really the challenge. How do we make sure that artificial intelligence is transparent and communicates in a really transparent way with us, with society, how assumptions are being made and how conclusions are being drawn? How can we as members of society see, who is behind that system and how these evaluations have been made?
Well, especially if this system might be used in a workplace to assess whether or not I get a job. So it's good that you've raised awareness, but what are we going to do about this, Nils?
There's a really urgent need for more public debate around the ethical issues of artificial intelligence. There's also a really urgent need for the public to better understand what artificial intelligence actually is.
Chrissy, you were talking about something similar.
Yes, the debate has already started about bias in algorithms and how AI can be biased. Obviously, we've seen examples of that in the media and the press already. Ethically, morally, certainly in legal terms, we may find at some point in the future there's going to be plenty of people who will make claims against companies to say that I was unfairly not selected for this particular role because you've used a machine rather than being overseen by a human, and I didn't even get to the first interview based on a machine selection.
Tim, how might AI and face recognition be used in blue-collar industries in the future?
In the bright future, it's helping people. It's trying to reduce hazards in the workplace, mishaps, abuse, bullying, these kinds of things. I think that's the positive use of intelligence. The negative use is potentially abuse by employers. There's definitely a commercial opportunity for a company to take a technology the kind of technology we've got, and say, okay, let's let's monitor somebody and ultimately control them. And that's, I think, the line in all of this is, do you want an AI to be in control of you or to be helping you?
That's certainly food for thought about AI and the future of workplaces. I hope my Nissan doesn't slap me in the face in the future. Tim Edwards, thank you. Tim is the Chief Technology Officer at Seeing Machines. Our other guests were Chrissy Lightfoot, who is a legal futurist and co-founder of Robot Lawyer Lisa, love that name, and Niels Wouters, a research fellow at the University of Melbourne. Thank you to all of you. You're listening to Best Practice on RN. In the biz, it's called a side hustle. That's when people have a job on the side that's different and sometimes very different from their 9-to-5 work. Wenny Yap is a side hustler. Thanks for joining us, Wenny.
Pleasure to be here.
Wenny, you don't just have one or two jobs. You've actually got three jobs. You work in marketing, you teach law to university students at UTS in Sydney, and you write all the content for our legal magazine's blog.
Yes, I do. Yes. And I've gotten a fourth job now, my main job, my main 9-to-5, where I work in the global marketing team for a legal software company.
Let's take you back to January 2015 when you began a rather unusual side hustle.
Yes. I gathered a group of friends and people that were working with my marketing firm at the time, and we decided to give a cat cafe a shot in Sydney, where you can go visit rescue cats. And basically, by visiting them, you're helping to socialise them. You can adopt them as well. And it's just a good thing for city people to do. I'm a city person. I don't get to see animals that much. So it's a time to sort of disconnect and reconnect in many ways with being where you are and being with the cat who may or may not give you love. We launched a crowdfunding campaign, which went crazy. We raised $4,000 in 4 hours and ended up raising about $40,000.
Wow. That's a lot of cat lovers out there.
Oh, yeah. That was just from pre-bookings, just people who wanted to support the idea and be the first through the door. So we were booked out for our first 2 months when we launched in July 2015. So we pulled it together very quickly. And it's been doing pretty well ever since. We launched a few other sort of events around it. So I launched something called Cat Yoga, where you do yoga with cats.
Does that work? Do the cats follow in the yoga?
No, they just interrupt you. They seem to judge the yoga pretty gravely, actually. We ended up getting featured all over the place. We have had the Mountain from Game of Thrones come to visit us, a giant man with a tiny kitten just being filmed for BuzzFeed. That was a strange day. So it's been quite a ride. And throughout that, something that I only found out about a month before we launched is that I'm slightly allergic to cats.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
Hang on. So you've started a cat cafe and you didn't know that you were allergic?
Well, I'm not allergic to one cat or two cats. I kind of always had them around. But I remember the moment that I realized that I might be allergic was when I was in a room with 17 of them. We were setting up, getting ready for launch in about a week, and I just started sneezing uncontrollably. Like, oh, God, just put my home deposit into this. What a great idea.
So what did you do? Did you have to wear a full body suit or anything like that?
It wasn't really that bad. Like, I couldn't stay longer than about 2 hours or so in the cat room, but there's also a cafe area. And so I did other tasks, and I was very much behind the marketing, which is really where my skills base has been.
What have been the main difference between your day jobs and this side hustle?
Well, this particular side hustle was just a wild idea. You wouldn't do it to save money. It's a good venture and it was an interesting experience. But really, when it came to my day jobs were about following a strong professional skill set and passion as well. So in many ways, there's not a huge difference, is that my day jobs pay better.
Tell us about the hard stuff and what you learned from that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I had launched a few businesses prior to Catmosphere, but they'd all been online. So I launched something called Survive Law, which went on to become Australia's sort of highest traffic law student website. And that was nice and contained. But with Catmosphere, it was bricks and mortar, which broke one of my big rules of don't launch bricks and mortar because it will take a lot of time and money. It was in skill sets that I really had no idea about. I didn't know that much about cats. I'd never run a cafe before. It was an insane concept. The only thing that I was good at leading up to it was publicizing it and fundraising for it and just having the sort of willingness and energy to push through and bring a lot of people on the journey who were incredibly helpful.
Wani Yap, thanks for joining us and talking Side Hustle.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And that's all for today. Thanks to our producer, Verica Jokic, and our technical producer, Jack Montgomery Parks. You can hear this program again by clicking on Listen Now on our website and by downloading the program via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.